of this antenna pattern. You make some change to its impedance, but you make very little difference to its pattern. And if the dipole in your backyard on 80 meters is supposed to be 132 feet long, and you decide to build it 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long, the common sense will say, boy, that's going to be very low in performance. If you're smart enough to put the right loading coil in the center to bring it back into resonance, you'll get the full half-wave dipole performance. Gain, effective capture area and reception, pattern, the works. The infinitesimal size dipole, as long as it's brought back into resonance, within half a dB, gives you the full performance of the full 132 feet long piece of wire. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. A few people have tried that experiment, and they said, wow, how come? Because you're feeding energy into a resonator. The fact that you've made it shorter means the signal is now going to bounce, instead of 20 times, it's going to bounce 100 times. It's a more narrow band antenna, it's got higher Q. But on your favorite frequency where you've tuned it, it's going to give you full performance. Ain't that crazy? How many books say that? It's about time. Any further comments at all of the above, will do. NY2H from the ferry. K2R
repeater. Time out.
Going to give you the call letters again. NY2H from the ferry. K2RIW. Go ahead, Lou.
Final comment question following this line. We talk about impedance, load impedance, and we know impedance gives us the relationship between the voltage and the current, phase and amplitude relationship, so on and so forth. But we also talk about radiation resistance, which I believe is a parallel to that, but maybe I need a little clarification on that. And I guess the radiation resistance deals with the E and the H field. Is the load impedance the same as the radiation resistance?
At 98%, the answer is yes, Lou. When you're using a good vector network analyzer, scalar network analyzer, slotted line, antenna tuner-like things, whenever you use any kind of instrumentation, and at your favorite frequency, you measure the impedance of your antenna. In the general case, the impedance of your antenna will have a resistive component and a reactive component, and we treat them as separate items. In reality, they're sort of really lumped together as one particular dot somewhere in the middle of that Smith chart. You put a dot somewhere in that Smith chart, and it defines the exact impedance, and that's what your well-calibrated vector network analyzer will teach you, will give you as an output indication. And so it only has that impedance while it is radiating. Let me give you an example of that. Let me drop. I can take a full half-wave dipole and shield it. The best way I know to shield it is I build the dipole out of coaxial cable. The radiator I build out of coaxial cable. I leave the shield on the dipole, the outer coaxial cable. I leave the shield on the whole half-wave length. I've drilled a couple of holes in the side of the shield near the center, and I'm feeding the center conductor. The center conductor is electronically exactly a half wavelength long, quarter wave to the right, quarter wave to the left, and I'm feeding that shielded dipole. And I've left the shield on it, so now it cannot radiate, except for a little bit of signal that squirts out from the end, and I put some end caps to make sure that doesn't do it. Assume now that I've got very low loss coax, and I've got very high conductivity center conductor, silver plated. And it's got the exact same resonance phenomenon. The signal travels down it, goes to the outer end, sees that open circuit, and reflects back. And because I've made the length exactly the right length to be resonant, all of those bounces are now co-phased. You do that, and you get an extremely interesting experiment. That is, because it is shielded, it has no ability to radiate, except for the little bit of resistive loss in the copper, so to speak, or the dielectric loss of the material, and I could make it air-filled coax. I could do this out of Angel Heliax. Because all the signals are down to the end and doesn't leak out into space, and all of it reflects back. And it reflects back exactly 180 degrees out of phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter. I will measure approximately 0 ohms of impedance at resonance. There'll be no reactance, impedance will be 0 ohms. If the signal didn't radiate, the signal coming back is equal in amplitude to what went out on the previous cycle, if you know what I mean, because it come back 180 degrees out of phase, equal in amplitude, gives you a cancellation. The repeater, time out. The current goes as high as it wants to go. The voltage is 0. That's the definition of 0 ohm impedance. If there was no radiation resistance, so to speak, if there was no radiation, the impedance you measure would be 0. If the dipole did what you would like to believe in your brain, that you launch the signal from the transmission line onto the dipole, you'd like to believe it starts traveling down the wire and jumps into space. If it did that, the impedance you would measure would be almost infinity, and there would be no resonance. The signal traveling down the wire would jump into space. When it gets down to the end of the wire, there would be nothing left over, nothing to reflect back. You'd have no way of knowing that the dipole is too long or too short. You wouldn't measure any out-of-resonance phenomena. So if you had perfect resonance, the so-called resistive impedance would be infinity. If you have no radiation, the impedance you measure is 0. The fact that 5% of it radiates on each bounce and the way it comes back is not a complete cancellation, that's where the 73 ohms is coming from. Ain't that crazy? None of the books explain it that way. That's my way of explaining it. It may be not the perfect explanation, but for me it works. I've used it as a mental model of what's going on. It's allowed me to design antennas, and my name is on 28 patents of antennas using that philosophy, Lou. NY2H, I'll bet you've never heard that one before. T2RAW, Lou on the ferry, go right ahead.
NY2H, all right, so I picture it as a nozzle, and you've got the nozzle wide open or completely shut. When it's completely shut, I guess you have a reflective coefficient of 1. When it's completely open, when we get our intermediate impedances, it's the effect of the nozzle being partially open. Is that kind of a good analogy?
Give that man a cigar. I like it, Lou. The open and closed nozzle. Yes, it's the nozzle on the end of the hose, and you're determining what impedance the faucet sees as it's pumping water in that hose, depending on whether you have the nozzle completely closed, partially open, or open all the way. That's a good analogy. That faucet feeding water into your garden hose is a kind of a transmitter. The garden hose is a kind of a transmission line, a feed line, and the nozzle at the end is determining how much radiation you get. That's not a bad mechanical analogy to an antenna. How it relates to the way that radio signal gets radiated into space and how the water squirts out of the end of the nozzle, you got to be careful with this one. Let me show you a trap, though, Lou. A buddy of mine literally filed for a patent on an antenna in which he assumed the signal squirting out of the end of the antenna is like water squirting out of a hose. So he decided to make a cavity-backed spiral antenna. He decided to make the antenna smaller and smaller in physical diameter because he thought it would be more like a smaller and smaller nozzle out of the end of a hose. Therefore, the signal would have a smaller and smaller beam width of the radiated signal. The main lobe would be a smaller number of degrees. He had it backwards. The number of wavelengths of the aperture of the antenna determines your beam width, and the rough rule of thumb is 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths. If my antenna, my horn, was one wavelength wide at the mouth, it would have roughly a 70 degree beam width. If I made it two wavelengths wide, it would be a 35 degree beam width. So except for that slight glitch, if you know what I mean, it's a darn good analogy, and I wonder if you've ever heard that one before. Did you invent it right on the spot, Lou? NY2H on the ferry, KQLIW in the TechNet.
No, I hadn't heard it. I'm trying to visualize these concepts. You know, I think I told you during the week I've been studying the Smith chart and reflection coefficients and how they relate to SWR. I think when you square it or something, like 0.7 is like a 5-to-1 or something. So, you know, I'm starting to crystallize some of these concepts. I'm trying to build a mental model in my head. So that's where that came from. I'll say a little bit unclear on the radiation resistance as it relates to load impedance. And I guess in your examples, when you had a radiation, when you had an impedance of zero, wide open, or you had impedance of infinity, with the radiation resistance. Is the radiation resistance basically the same concept but is applied to E and H fields rather than voltage and current as our impedance relates to?
ACQ, what time is? Glenn recognized in about 2 minutes, I'm going to get to you, Glenn. You got to be careful with that one, Lou. Glenn and I are slowly coming up with a philosophy. At least I'm coming up with a philosophy, and I think I'm slowly convincing Glenn, and it's a radical idea. My radical idea is that it's all in the magnetics. It is my belief that the majority of what that dipole does to read a signal in space is to make a strong cyclic magnetic field. As current flows down that wire, and by the right-hand rule, my thumb points in the direction the current flows, my fingers are wrapped around the wire. My fingers wrapping around the wire shows you the way the lines of magnetic field form around that piece of wire when current is flowing through it. And that magnetic field radiates in space, that cyclic magnetic field, is in my mind the beginning of the radiation process, and I'm slowly trying to convince Glenn that I think it might be 99%. I think, repeater, time out. I believe that what goes into space is primarily a cyclic magnetic field. And yes, when you make measurements with the usual instrumentation, that magnetic field hits the conductor of your receiving antenna. The cyclic magnetic field, by Faraday's law, sets up a voltage on your piece of wire. And therefore, you sense a voltage. You think there was an E field in space. I'm not convinced there really was. The cyclic magnetic field and Faraday's law would have done it. So, but you got it right. In the case of the thoroughly shielded dipole, because I built it inside of angiohelix, and none of the signal has a chance to radiate, and it's all reflective, you'll now measure what looks like a radiation impedance of 0 ohm. You're setting up a current, you're sending that energy down the wire, it bounces off the output open end, the end of the wire, but it's all shielded, none of it got radiated, all of it bounces back to you, a reflection coefficient of unity, it comes back 180 degrees out of phase. It took a quarter wavelength of time to go down, another quarter wavelength of time to come back, it comes back a half wavelength out of phase, it becomes a perfect short circuit with what's coming out of your transmitter at this time, and you measure 0 ohm impedance. So the so-called radiation resistance, radiation impedance you measure, is really a function of what percentage got radiated. And if all of it got radiated on the first pass, you measure infinity. Because a fraction gets radiated, what comes back is only a partial cancellation, you measure 73 ohms. That's the way I see it. And to say, let me drop one more time. To say your antenna is launching a certain ratio of E field and H field, there are people who have come up with that model, and for them that model works. I'm not convinced there's an E field in space, because there's lots of places where Glenn and I have intentionally set up an E field inside of that GTEM testing fixture, which is really a great big feed horn, so to speak, a very large diameter piece of coax cable, where you know how many volts you're putting on that center conductor. You know the outside is shielded. You know the outside is 2 feet away. So if I put 2 volts on that center conductor and the outside shield is 2 feet away, I know I've set up 1 volt per 1 volt per foot, so to speak. Or if it was 1 to 2 meters, it would be 1 volt per meter. You know what I mean? So yes, in that situation, you've got a real conductor. You're putting real electrons on the conductor, and you set up a real E field, and you put your device on the test in that GTAM testing fixture, and you measure its susceptibility to some number of volts per meter. It takes real conductors, real electrons, in order to set up an E field. And here we are led to believe by everything we've read. Let me drop it. Led to believe that radiated wave in space has an E field and an H field. The H field I accept. There was lots of current flowing into that dipole. Because the dipole had a Q of 10, that means whatever current the transmission line launched into it the current flowing in some portion of the dipole itself is 10 times higher. One of the definitions of Q is voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance. So the dipole has 10 times more current than your transmission line somewhere in it because of the resonance phenomena. That sets up 10 times bigger magnetic field, and the magnetic field does the radiating. But that field in space, there ain't no conductors there. Not one single electron leaves your antenna. So that so-called EH field in space, that transverse electromagnetic field, it has no conductors, it has no electrons, and yet we say it has volts per meter. How did you do that? By way of setting up a conductor as the receiving antenna in that cyclic magnetic field, along with Faraday's law, which means how fast the current is changing, how fast the magnetic field is changing in your conductor, determines how many volts your conductor gets on it. By Faraday's law, you send a voltage, you pick up a voltage on your receiving wire. That doesn't mean that free space had it. Free space only needs the magnetic field, in my mind. So I'm coming up with a brand new diagram as to what I think an electromagnetic field is. Not everybody's going to agree with one. I know darn well it's controversial. See where Glenn finds himself on all of this. KCQQIQ, straighten us out here, Glenn. HRLIW in the tech man.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Lou. Yeah, I just wanted to mention a couple of simple things about that were missed about radiation resistance. One of the key things to radiation resistance, Lou, is length. If you look at the length of any radiator, you can directly calculate the radiation resistance in free space just by its overall length. So in other words, if you just remember the equation, the physical length of your radiator divided by wavelength squared times 20 pi squared will always give you the radiation resistance in free space. So basically, it's really a length relationship. So when what actually gives you why is the antenna's impedance at half wave in the dipole, around 73 ohms, the real reason is because of that equation that I just gave you right there. It's directly related to resistance. As far as electromagnetic waves, you may want to wait for me a little bit later because my description there might be a little bit longer, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, that's a very nice formula, but there's a catch. That formula is in my opinion, it's not an exact mathematical derivation. It is a form fit. In other words, somebody has looked at the equivalent of the Brown and Woodward curve. The Brown and Woodward curve shows you how the resistive component, radiation resistance, changes as a function of length and wavelength. The Brown and Woodward curves, by the way, the horizontal axis happens to be degrees, and degrees and wavelength have a one-to-one relationship. 360 degrees is one wave, 180 degrees is half wave, 90 degrees is a quarter wave, and so on. So it's rated in degrees, but it's the same thing. And the radiation resistance goes up as a function of length up to one wave. Let me think now. Up to half wave when you're feeding a monopole, which is full wave in space. Then the resistive component comes back down again. The formula doesn't recognize that. So for the usual length of the dipoles we usually set up, very rarely do we set up a dipole more than one wavelength long. If we did, the formula would fail because it's a form-fitting formula. It's not a mathematical derivation. So it's a good approximation. The Brown-Woodward curve is much more exact, in my opinion, because when you look at the Brown-Woodward curve, it's got some funny shapes to it. And by the way, the Brown-Woodward curve has a different amount of resistive impedance depending on the diameter of the radiator. Very sensitive to diameter as you start approaching a half wavelength in length. And so one of my patents for a dipole, let me drop dipole-like antenna. Is if you're making the dipole at 900 megacycles and you're making it out of brass sheet metal, and you make the dipole half wavelength long electronically, but a quarter wavelength wide in width, it's a fat, funny-looking sheet metal dipole. It takes very little material to do it as far as dollars are concerned. But you end up with extremely wide impedance when you do that. And so that formula would fail miserably in that particular case. So in the real world, diameter of the dipole counts. The the formula that you just gave us, Glenn, is very good for the usual diameter of the dipole, usual length up to half wave, full wave for the whole dipole. But whether impedance starts coming back down again, that formula doesn't represent that. Let me give it back to Glenn for his rebuttal on what I just said. KC2QIQ, KQLIW in the tech man. You got it, Glenn.
No, there's no real rebuttal on what you're saying, Dick. I definitely agree with it. The only thing that I wanted to just add to that is that basically that equation is representing one part of the equation. It's not complete. But like you said, for the when somebody's going to measure a dipole, like they're going to take some 14-gauge wire and they're going to start spreading it out and they're looking for where the radiation resistance is in the antenna, that's a very, very quick indicator of what's going on. So in other words, when you're looking at the length of the antenna, the length is a big part of it. Now, yes, in terms of, because it's a geometric impedance. So in other words, when you start going into a square shape, in other words, first we're talking about the length of a dipole. Typically, we're talking about a wire. But in other words, if you start talking about more exotic shapes, like you start getting into plates, yes, then the impedance changes. That's why exactly for that reason that equation is R is equal to 40 pi squared times the length over the wavelength, the physical length over the wavelength squared in the quarter wave ground plane. And that's why the impedance of the quarter wave ground plane is 36.5 ohms, not the 72. So, yes, there are modifications to that, but the key point I was really trying to put out, Dick, is just that radiation resistance is really associated to length. And when you're looking at quarter wavelengths and shorter, the radiation resistance is small. As the antenna starts getting close to a full wavelength, you're reaching the maximum radiation impedance. So it's just a good thing to keep in mind, I think, when you're, you know, looking at what radiation resistance is and its relationship back to the feed line. So in other words, where you're going to attach your feed line to the antenna at that point with your matching circuit, it's always a good thing to keep in mind of what your radiation resistance is and your impedance matching circuit. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In a peculiar way, Glenn, you and I are on the same page. I'm addressing it from the Brown and Woodward curve, which is real measured data in the Neil laboratory. Remember I said that as a function of length, the resistive component can be made any impedance you want between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohm inclusive just by changing the length of the wire. That's what the Brown and Woodward curve tells me for a particular diameter of wire. Just changing length, I can go from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms. You're doing it by way of an equation for length over wavelength and the quantity squared multiplied by a constant. And it's a good rule of thumb that gets you probably 95% accuracy most of the time for reasonable diameters. The Brown and Woodward curve shows me real measured data for real diameters that are either reasonable or unreasonable. He goes up to a 4-to-1 ratio of diameter to length ratio, which is very close to... Oh, I went beyond that. I went to half, so to speak, and that sheet metal, I think. And what another thing that Mother Nature does is that your and my eye, with its very high resolution, wavelength-wise, as far as radio is concerned, we look at the fine details. We look at the piece of wire and say the piece of wire has a round cross-section. Let me drop. The cross-section of the wire might be round, square, triangular, or flat like a piece of sheet metal. What Mother Nature's RF does is she's got a very low-resolution set of fuzzy eyes. She looks at the equivalent. She takes that square thing and says, if it was round, what approximately would the diameter be that has approximately the same amount of area? You take your square, your triangular cross-section of the wire of your dipole, and you make it into a round equivalent as an approximation. With 95% accuracy, that's what Mother Nature does. She doesn't see those fine details. When you make a piece of coax cable, we usually do it with a round center conductor and a round outer conductor. Nothing magic about that. The center conductor can be round and the outer conductor can be square. That's the way many amateurs build themselves a 4-to-1 balance. They use square, one inch square tubing for the outer, and they use a round K and E pieces of tubing bought at a hobby store of the right diameter for the center conductor, so in order to make a 37 ohm impedance cable, so to speak, to give a perfect impedance match with 27 ohm. So round center and square outer, perfectly good. completely flat center and round outer particularly good. In the case of strip line, your strip line, you've got an infinite sheet for the upper ground plane, an infinite sheet for the lower ground plane, and a center conductor that is a sheet of metal halfway between the two. That's a particular width that gives you a 70 ohms or 50 ohms, if that's what you want. So when it comes to transmission lines and radiators, there's nothing magic about it being round, flat, square, triangular, whatever you want. All of them work. And slowly we're getting a little bit more understanding of what an antenna is, Lou. And I think you've got a couple more. Let's see if he's got another fire hose example on this one. NY2H. On the ferry. Where are you on the ferry? K2LIW in the tech net. Go ahead, Lou.
Repeater. Time out.
Alrighty, by the bilge. Alright, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to immerse myself in the internet and radiation resistance to fill in some of the gaps, try to get a mental picture on my own. I'm not going to hold it much any longer. I'll let you progress. You know, people online waiting. But still very interesting. I thank you very much for the comments. And, you know, it's to be continued. So thanks again, NY2H.
Now, a person listening off to one side might think that these guys are showing their pride with their individual opinions as to what's happening and that they're having a debate. Not a debate at all, in my opinion. We are all trying to create a clearer mental image of what an antenna is, what a dipole is, what the impedance match of a dipole is, how do you feed it, what does a signal look like in space. We're trying to come up with mental images, and we're teaching ourselves, it's the blind leading the blind a little bit here, but we're slowly teaching ourselves. I mean, I've been working in the antenna design field for a whole lot of years. I've got a whole bunch of opinions that, for me, work. Glenn has got a whole bunch of that, mental images of how a magnetic field exists inside of a transformer, inside of an inductor, inside of an inverter circuit. He's got a bunch of mental images that work for him on ferrite, tape wound, and whatever. We all have these mental images. I've got a bunch of mental images as to how the radar cross-section of certain objects in space, how does that work? How do you get that great big reflection off of an airplane at certain angles, and you move off 2 degrees and the reflection goes down to almost zero? How in the world did the airplane do that? The spike and fuzzball phenomenon. I got a bunch of mental images on that. You guys are getting the benefit of these discussions. We're teaching ourselves something. I hope I haven't spent too much time on this one, and we put Jim to bed. Jim, I know you signed in late, but I think you got a question for us. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee, in Port Washington. How's that new transmitter of yours coming along, Jim? K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, the transmitter's doing all right. I took it apart. I got a bit frustrated and decided to reassemble it. I found a lot of mistakes in the wiring, so I just decided to start all over and see what I can do better. But my question today was not about the transmitter. I haven't been on the radio in a while, and I kind of got bored of HF, so I kind of wanted to try 2-meter SSD. Besides the radio, what kind of 2-meter SSD antenna can I build that will work well on 2-meter SSD?
Great question, Jim. When it comes to 2 meters, in my mind, by far, you cannot beat the performance of a well-tuned, well-designed Yagi antenna. You get more decibels of gain per dollar, per pound, per wind load, square foot. A well-designed Yagi on 2 meters. Let me give you an example. If you and I could, with pieces of aluminum tubing, and if you wanted to, you could use the elements out of coat hanger wire or pieces of a 3/16 diameter aluminum rod, you could build a Yagi which has, let me pick a number, 10 elements to it. And that 10-element 2-meter Yagi, if you're talking to the FM people, you'd set it vertically polarized. If you're talking to the sideband people, you'd use it horizontally polarized. That's just the tradition. All the sideband people on 2 meters, 99% of them are horizontal. All the FM people on 2 meters, 99% of them are vertical. So, and my Yagi, the one you're listening to right now, is slanted at a 45-degree angle. I'm halfway between both so I can talk to both. So, in that Yagi, exactly as just described. 10 elements, 2 meters, I'm not sure exactly, but maybe the boom would be in the vicinity of 10 foot long. A little bit big, but with the right kind of a rotator on a good strong chimney mount, you could mount it on the chimney of your house. That dipole antenna would have a weight, that Yagi antenna I just described, would probably have about 2 pounds of weight. It would probably have about 1 or 2 square foot of wind load. But the radio effective area, if you look down that throat of that dipole, and if your eyes operated at 2 meters, what would you see? You would see a black hole in space 12 feet in diameter. I'm not kidding. In other words, when you're receiving with that antenna, it is gathering antenna from a 12-foot diameter of space, 110 square feet. Repeater, time out. Once again, something like a 12-foot diameter of space, something like 110 square feet. It's gathering all the energy coming into your backyard across that 110 square feet. As those, all those directors, those 9 directors, 8 directors, are focusing it down to that driven element. All the energy goes down the transmission line, takes the S-meter on your receiver. So, without a doubt, you can't beat Yagi. In order to build a parabolic dish antenna of the same amount of gain, it would have to be more than 15 feet in diameter, and it would have 200 square feet of wind load, it would have 150 pounds of weight, and your family would never allow you to mount it on the chimney. But those two antennas, the 15-foot diameter parabolic dish, and that simple couple of pounds of Yagi, would have the exact same amount of gain on transmit and receive. To build a horn antenna on 2 meters, again, it would be almost a 15-foot diameter to the throat of the horn. As you can tell, that Yagi has got a lot of magic to it with very little material. It's a real skeleton structure. Now, for you to find the right Yagi design, consider looking for the Gunter Hawk design, DL6W, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He is their Yagi. On planet Earth, there are a few people who are really expert at Yagis, and he's the guy. He published a whole bunch of articles in the German magazine. The various equivalents of that have appeared in the United States. The equivalent that I can think of is the one by Steve Polish, K1FO, Kilo 1 Foxtrot Oscar. You Google either of those call letters and you look at their Yagi designs and copy them with your materials, you're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar. Let me drop. When it comes to portable 2-meter Yagis, the best Yagi in the world is the one that's done out of yellow steel tape measure material. It's a stuffed carpenter's tape measure. That's foldable Yagi that was in the Rah-Rah, the name of the journal. This is the Radio Amateurs of Rochester, Rochester Amateur Radio Association. And if you go to Bernie's site, K2 Yankee Oscar, you'll find the Rah-Rah article. That's a particular website. You go there and you can easily build this 4-element Yagi out of a tape metal material. And what makes it so nice is that if you're into radio sport, where you want to fold up this antenna, put it into a tube, tuck it into the trunk of your car, and then when you get on site, you just let go of it, and the tape measure elements, the 4 elements, spring into action, if you know what I mean, and now you're ready to go. So, when it comes to high performance on 2 meters, the best you're going to do is a Yagi. And now whether or not you build a 3-element, a 13-element, or a 30-element Yagi is your choice and how much resources you want to put into it. They're not going to do any better than that, in my opinion. That combined with a good all-mode receiver, a sideband receiver, my favorite happens to be the one you're listening to, Kenwood TS711A, an oldie but goodie. On the surplus market, you can get one of those for $200, $300, and it's got a built-in power supply, variable power output, adjustable from the front panel. The world's best synthesizer I've ever seen. It's only got 40 memories. Doesn't have all the lore, the best horns and whistles, but you buy the modern-day all-mode rig that's got the exact same performance as that rig, you'll pay $1,700, and it's not that different from this $300 used piece of equipment, if you know what I mean. Maybe that's some of the information you're looking for. You're allowed to ask this question a whole lot of times, Jim. KH2BHY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Hey, Chip, I think I'm going to build one. I was thinking about it, and I just wanted to know if that was the best option, and sounds like it is. And also, can I just use regular RG-58 coil?
Absolutely. By the way, when it comes to inexpensive, fast-to-build Yagi, another set of call letters to write down. The first call letters I gave you were DL6W, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. The second call letters I asked you to look for is a K1FO, Kilo 1 Foxtrot Oscar. The third set of call letters are WA5EJV, Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulietBravo.com. WA5EJV.com. You go to that website where he sells these beautiful green printed circuit UHF, VHF antennas. You go to his second page, and he shows you how to build coat hanger wire antennas, Yagi antennas. Very inexpensive. And by the way, he uses half-folded dipole feed, and he holds the patent on that feeding scheme. And at first you look at that and you say, hey, that's an unbalanced antenna. You suddenly realize, hey, it's a flywheel, and I'm pumping energy into the flywheel. It doesn't have to be symmetric. So he uses coat hanger wire, and he uses a simple piece of the wood, and he builds these very inexpensive, you know, $1 type portable Yagi antennas. Now, when it comes to the transmission line, let me drop it. If your transmission line between your transmitter and that antenna is going to be 10 feet long, RG-58 will work like a charm. If it's going to be 100 feet long, RG-58 is going to start getting lossy. That doesn't knock you off the air. It just means that the 10 watts coming out of your transmitter, only 5 watts gets to the antenna, if you know what I mean. That's not a showstopper. A 5-watt rig on 2 meters can do very well. One of the things you'll discover on sideband, once you've got some kind of a Yagi-like antenna on the chimney, and anything more than 10 watts, and if you could possibly get 100 watts on sideband on 2 meters, you'll be talking to people in almost all of the New England states, at least half of New York State, all of New Jersey, half of Pennsylvania, all of Maryland and Delaware, with a little bit of good openings on the band. You'll be talking to the people in Virginia and North Carolina on 2-meter sideband from the chimney of your house. Sideband has got such a huge threshold advantage for weak signals. A good sideband receiver. One other thing to know about, let me drop. Is that almost every sideband all-mode rig that you can buy, the manufacturer, because most of them are Southeast Asia manufactured, and there you've got a ham on every street corner, and so front-end overload is very important. As such, they make sure the receiver has high dynamic range, and therefore it's got very low gain in the front end. They're gain-starved. Almost all of the rice boxes you and I can buy on sideband, that's a slang meaning it's the Southeast Asia made, they almost all have a 12 decibel noise figure when barefoot. That's not a showstopper. It'll get you on the air. But you'll rapidly realize that a hell of a lot of the people that can hear you, you're not hearing them because you've got a 12 dB noise figure. At some later time, you're going to get your hands on an Advanced Receiver Research preamplifier, my favorite brand. You're going to add that gas-fed low noise preamplifier in front of the transceiver. That brings your noise figure from 12 dB down to 1 dB, and you'll have roughly 12 decibels more sensitivity, 2 S units more sensitivity when it comes to listen to signals on sideband. Once you've got that front-end preamplifier on your sideband receiver and a good Yagi antenna, you'll be hearing weak signals like you wouldn't believe. You'll be hearing guys from all of those states I just mentioned. You'll be amazed that as you aim the antenna in various directions, you'll hear the static coming from power lines. You'll be able to zero in on it as if you were aiming a flashlight at them, if you know what I mean. You'll discover that one particular power transformer on a telephone pole 4 miles from you to the northeast is the one that when you aim in that direction, you hear the 60-cycle noise coming out of that transformer. You turn on the noise blanker of a good receiver, and that problem goes away. You don't even hear it anymore. These are some of the things you'll discover. You'll also discover, let me drop. As you tune around 144.0, plus or minus about 30 kilohertz, you'll hear a whole bunch of individual weak tones. And those weak tones will be beep, beep, beep. What they are, of all the people in your neighborhood that are running radio scanners where they're listening to fire and police and whatever, many of them have a basic frequency synthesizer where the reference oscillator is on 8 megacycles or some harmonic of that, and as that scanner is scanning through all those frequencies, the receiver that they're using, the local oscillator, is doing a little bit of transmitting through that antenna, and you're hearing that. By aiming your Yagi antenna into various directions in your neighborhood, you will find the people who are using police and fire and ambulance receivers, scanners, and you'll be hearing the local oscillators coming out of their receivers on your 2-meter Yagi. There's a lot of interesting things you're about to find out about, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the Tech Mag.
Thanks for that information, Dick. Yeah, I just kind of got bored of HF and haven't been on the air in like 3 weeks, so it's nice to get to meet your sideband to try, and yeah, I think I'm going to start to build that antenna, get some coax, and that radio you were talking about, I'm looking it up on the internet right now, it doesn't look too expensive, which is good.
As I said, my favorite transceiver on 2 meters, bar none, is the Kenwood TS711A. Oldie but goodie. It's a 1989 design, somewhere around there. Built-in power supply. The world's best frequency synthesizer. Only got 30 to 40 memories. But it's got upper sideband, lower sideband, FM, CW. Doesn't have AM. And it has got a variable knob on the front panel that goes from 1 watt to 30 watts output. 30 watts output is not super high. But at some later time, you can add an afterburner, a Mirage amplifier or whatever after it to bring you up to higher power if that's what you want to do. But 30 watts of clean sideband, and it's got a nice built-in speech processor too, by the way, 30 watts of clean sideband, you'll be amazed what kind of range you'll get without repeaters, as long as you're not in a hole. Most of Port Washington is reasonably high land, and with that antenna, that Yagi antenna on the roof, with a rotator, just a, you know, an inexpensive television rotator. It'll give you a lot of fun. The sideband people are a different class of people. They're a little bit more technically oriented. There's not quite as many of them, I'll warn you. You get on this particular repeater on a Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock and you call C2, you say 82BHY and I'm listening, and you'll get an immediate answer. On sideband at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, not quite as many people. During the VHF contest, and there's about 4 or 5 contests per year, you'll be listening across the 2-meter band and you'll think you're on 20 meters at Saturday morning, if you know what I mean. You'll hear CW, sideband, FM, you'll hear all kinds of things. The band will be super crowded during a VHF contest. So it's and those guys on 2-meter sideband, as I said, are a different class of people, a little bit more technically oriented. They get into some pretty deep discussions of antennas, transmission lines, and so on. The RG58 that you want to use, let me drop. As long as you're not running 100 feet of it, it's not a bad transmission line. By the way, when you're using a lossy, small diameter, long length of transmission line, it doesn't suddenly die at some particular length. It's just that every time you double the length, you double the number of dB of loss of the cable. If at some later time you get a chance to run RG8, which will be better in loss than RG58, or half-inch or three-quarter-inch television CATV hardline, which you can get free of charge in many cases. That's much lower in loss yet. Since you may own a piece of 7/8-inch Andrew hardline cable, there are all kinds of transmission lines that are much lower in loss than RG58. And these will be step-by-step making an improvement in your system. But to start off with what you've got, RG58, it'll work like a charm. Just that know that it can be done better at a later time. Keep us posted on that project, Jim, and good luck with that one. Sideband, I think you're going to find a lot of fun. We've gone down the list of people who signed in with an immediate small question. Time we go to the mailbag, and I'm late on that one, John, but take your time. And what are those geniuses that write to you are asking today? Are they trying to build a piece of electronics to go to the moon? KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KG2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul, everyone on the net. Have some construction questions for you, Dick. We have a young gentleman who has a very nice signal generator. Let me let it drop and I'll pick this up. Okay. He has a nice signal generator which has an attenuating pad on it. What he did was he remachined it so that he could put a 10-turn dial on it. Now what he wants to do is calibrate the generator with a chart and know exactly how many microvolts he has output on the generator. His question is, does he have to terminate it at 50 ohms? It's a 50 ohm output generator. At the end of his cable, which is 1 meter long, does he have to put a 50 ohm resistor before he establishes his RF microvoltmeter? And this way he can calibrate his dial. Well, back to you, Dick.
What a question. Question number one, before I go any further. This signal generator, what's the lowest and the highest frequency it goes to? And you'll soon see where I'm going on that one. I mean, if it was an audio signal generator, we've got a perfect answer for him. If it is a Hewlett-Packard 612 that goes to 1200 megacycles, we got a problem. So what's the frequency range of the signal generator? Question number one, John, go ahead.
Our standard generator, Dick, its maximum is, I believe, 500 megahertz.
Okay, one of the old-fashioned classic signal generators that goes to 500 megs was the Hewlett-Packard 608. And the Hewlett-Packard 608 has this extremely beautiful piston attenuator on the front panel that goes from roughly plus 5 dBm of output all the way down to minus 120 dBm of output, or minus 110. And that piston attenuator is extremely well calibrated at every one of the frequencies out of that signal generator, from 10 megs to roughly 470 megs inclusive. So if the signal generator really goes to 500 megs and has a piston attenuator in it, use it. When you take a simple resistive card type potentiometer, or the 10-turn equivalent of that, and you feed 500 megs through it, the multi-turn 10-turn potentiometer to a 500 meg signal, which is a 27-inch wavelength, as far as that signal is concerned, that multi-turn potentiometer of yours has got a whole lot of distributed inductance, a whole lot of distributed stray capacitance, and you think that you're doing a voltage divider network as you turn the dial on the 10-turn potentiometer, precision potentiometer. You think you're doing a simple voltage divider network, and if you're putting audio through it up to a couple of megacycles, you can get away with that. When you get anywhere near a couple of hundred megacycles and you put it through that network, it is extremely undefined until you calibrate it. In other words, you think when the pot is in the middle of all of its turns, you think you've got a 2-to-1 voltage divide ratio. Absolutely not. Not when it comes to that distributed inductance and distributed capacitance. And on top of that, in order for the signal generator to feed all of the circuits under test correctly, you would like the signal generator to look like a 50-ohm source. That's a 10-turn potentiometer. At one end of its turns, that's going to look like a 1,000-ohm source. At the other end of its turns, it's going to look like a 1-ohm source. And everywhere in between, it's going to look highly inductive, highly capacitive, and some other crazy resistive number. I'm not saying you can't do the 10-turn potentiometer. Yes, you can calibrate it, but it's not going to be a 50-ohm source. It's not going to be anywhere near as linear as you like, because you're not recognizing the fact that a 10-turn potentiometer was not designed as a UHF circuit. It was designed for DC or audio. Let me drop a couple other things I want to tell you.
Dick, by the way, that pot is the original attenuator. This is not something he installed. He only modified it for a 10-turn pot.
Wow. What brand name used a 1-turn resistive card potentiometer, if that's what it is? And maybe if you took it apart, you'll find out it's not what it is. It may be something very different. What brand of signal generator put what looks like a 1-turn potentiometer as the output network? What brand did that, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick, you might be right. I have not seen the inside or the diagram, but it is the shaft that's coming out that he converted. It's made by Weinshell.
Wow. Weinshell is one of the very respected RF companies. Weinshell, arguably Weinshell, is most famous for their precision attenuators. And they make Cadillacs. That's an extremely good company, Weinshell. They make all kinds of high-power attenuators, directional couplers, microwave circuits, high-precision, traceable to the Bureau, microwave circuits. If Weinshell made a signal generator with a one-turn potentiometer on the front panel, what looks like a potentiometer, then they've ironed out all of these details of the distributed capacitance, resistance, and whatever. Therefore, I do not recommend that he replace that circuit with a 10-turn pot. Absolutely not. What I recommend instead...
You're not understanding.
What I recommend instead is that he put some kind of a 10-turn mechanical divider network. In other words, if he puts on the front panel a device which every time he turns the knob in his hand 10 turns, that the real shaft moves one turn. If he does that mechanically to get more resolution, I'm in agreement. But that
vernier dial.
You got it, the vernier dial. If he puts a vernier dial on it, I'm in agreement. But if he's taking this beautiful Cadillac piece of equipment called Weinshell and substituting its output attenuator with anything else he can lay his hands on, I think he's taking a step backwards instead of a step forward. I'm going to give you a lot more information. Let me make sure I'm not going off on a big tangent on this one, John. KC2WGB, straighten me out. K2RIW in the tech man.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, you're going off a little bit. He's not changing anything. He adapted the 10-turn pot mechanical to the shaft on the front. It's identical. He's not changing anything. And all he wants to do is graph out the numbers versus frequency, microvolts. So that's what he's doing with it, because it doesn't have... I own two of these generators, different ones, but mine have meters on them. His, unfortunately, doesn't have a microvolt meter.
Now, John, are you saying he's adding a vernier device so that the knob in his hand turns more times than the shaft used to turn? Is that what he's adding? But he's leaving intact the original Weinshell attenuator behind that front panel. Is that what you're saying he's doing, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, that's exactly what he's doing, and he's putting the large type that you see on a lot of the HP and Tektronix stuff with a little knob that locks it in position once you set it. That's all he's doing, putting that mechanical adapter on it. Everything else is staying the same.
Okay, John, do you realize that when you first posed the problem, you said he's adding a 10-turn potentiometer? Do you see how you read the story on that one, John? Go ahead.
No, I believe 10-turn potentiometer drive. He's replacing it with the drive system, but now you got it.
Yeah, I had a tin ear in the way of my hearing. I didn't hear the word drive. I heard 10-turn potentiometer. Alrighty. Now, got some good news for him. If the signal generator made by Weinshell is doing the job that Weinshell usually does, throughout most of that range of that output attenuator circuit, that will be very close to a 50-ohm source signal generator. The magic of a 50-ohm source signal generator into a piece of 50-ohm cable, and the fact that it's 1 meter long or 10 meters long is a minor factor. Minor factor of its predictable insertion loss versus length when you tell me what brand of cable it is and what condition it's in. Excuse me. Now, once you've got a 50-ohm generator going into a 50-ohm cable, and you want to know what's going to happen when you put a 50-ohm load or an open circuit, believe it or not, that's extremely predictable. If I had a microvolt meter, which the meter itself presented a 50-ohm load, and I put that at the end of the cable, and I set it for, let me pick a number, 10 microvolts. I set the signal generator so that at the end of the cable, into my microvolt meter, presenting a 50 ohm load, I get 10 microvolts. Then I disconnect the 50 ohm load at the far end of the cable and present a perfect open circuit. And I've got this magic microvolt meter that can measure voltage without presenting any load to it. So my cable has gone from a 50 ohm load to an infant load. Sounds like a terrible condition. As long as the signal generator is 50 ohms and the cable is 50 ohms, when you go from a 50 ohm load to an open load, the voltage you present only doubles. It goes exactly 2-to-1 increase. If I set it to 10 microvolts when loaded, open circuit, it will be 20 microvolts. The funny thing about a 50 ohm signal generator, improperly loaded like that, it is exactly a 2-to-1 ratio. Repeater, time out. Put a short circuit at the end, and it'll go to 0 volts. By the way, if you study the way a time domain reflectometer works, the mathematics of what I'm describing is exactly the same. What voltage you get out of a time domain reflectometer when it looks into a 50 ohm load, an infinite load, or a 200 ohm load is very predictable. So therefore, the whole thing is predictable. If and only if the signal generator is a 50 ohm source. Let me show you what happens. In reality, let me drop for a second. The signal flowing out of the signal generator goes down that cable. It sees the open circuit. Every bit of it reflects back without phase shift and comes back to the signal generator. If the signal generator is a 50 ohm load, a 50 ohm source on the 50 ohm cable, all of the reflected signal gets absorbed at the signal generator. Everything's hunky-dory. It is exactly 2-to-1 ratio. If the signal generator is anything but 50 ohms, 40 ohms, 100 ohms, capacitive reactants, or whatever, then a small percentage of the signal coming back to the signal generator gets re-reflected forward, because that transmission line on the reverse mode didn't think it was properly terminated. The signal gets re-reflected forward, and depending on what frequency you're at, what length of cable, the new re-reflected signal is either in phase, out of phase, or in quadrature with the signal coming out of the signal generator at this time. The bottom line is if it was a sweeping signal generator, you'd see a bunch of ripples if the signal generator wasn't 50 ohms. But as long as the signal generator made by Weinschel is usually darn close to 50 ohms, that problem doesn't exist. Therefore, he's got exactly 2-to-1 when he open circuits it. And when he puts any other impedance on the end of the cable, capacitive, inductive, high impedance, low impedance, whatever, the formulas used with time domain reflectometry will tell him exactly what he's going to get. He's got a very well-defined situation. Wonder if that helps, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I'm not sure if he's at that level to understand that. I could find out. But basically, he was wondering if he just placed the 50 ohm resistor there at the end of the original Weinschel cable that he has, because it looks exactly like the one I had, if he could use his microvoltmeter. Now, whether his microvoltmeter is a Boonton like I have, which is a 50 ohm input impedance, that I don't know what he has to measure it with. So he was just wondering, to target it, would that be acceptable? Otherwise, he's going to have to get involved. Back to you, Dick.
I'm pretty sure the answer to what I think is the question is yes. Let me show you what the, where the minefield is here. At 500 megacycles, where the wavelength is around 24 inches or so, if I'm using a carbon composition resistor, RCO7, half watt, quarter watt carbon composition resistor, or if I'm using a surface mount resistor, and in either case, I keep the leads extremely short, mounted as close as possible to center conductor and shield of that cable or the connector that I put on the far end. In other words, I put the cable into a connector that goes into a box, a feed-through connector inside the box. I use very short leads of a 50 ohm resistor. That's going to work like a charm. If you're foolish enough to use very long leads on that resistor, in other words, the RCO7 carbon composition resistor comes with leads on each end that are an inch and a half long. and if I leave the inch and a half long lead on each end and bend them at a 90-degree angle so that the whole resistor looks like a great big U-shaped object with the resistor in the middle of the U, I take those great big long leads and I connect them to the connector inside the box, the V-through connector, I've now got a lot of excess inductive length to those leads, and I'm going to have a 50-ohm resistor in series with a 50 microhenry